ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Federal Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, announces a better-than-expected budget deficit. Also, voters in Moldova defy Russian interference and elect a pro-European government. And the Australian-made landmine detector set to speed up work in Ukraine.
Someone eventually, right, is carrying it into a minefield. You need to create technology which is light enough to carry, to use all day, hold it in place, detect mines, and do that smoothly.
The Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers has today been spruiking the government's economic management by pointing to a lower budget deficit than previously forecast. The deficit for the last financial year has come in at about $10 billion, about $18 billion less than expected. Economists have greeted the news with cautious optimism, but a warning the deficit is still forecast to increase in the coming years. Luke Radford reports.
It's not often that Treasurer Jim Chalmers is happy to be wrong.
In dollar terms, this is the biggest ever positive improvement in the budget in a single parliamentary term. In just 3 years in office, we've been able to engineer a $209 billion improvement in the budget over those 3 years.
The final budget outcome for the financial year 2024-25 was released today. It's one last check of how the budget performed over the 12 months. The top line is that the national deficit is nearly $18 billion better than what the government had originally predicted. Last year, the forecast was for the budget to be $28 billion in the red, but in the end, it was only $10 billion. Treasurer Jim Chalmers says that's thanks to a stronger-than-expected labour market.
We've been able to achieve this outcome because we have found savings, we've shown restraint, we've banked upward revisions to revenue, we've kept unemployment low, we've got real wages growing again, and you can see the dividends of all of that in the final budget outcome. This gives us one of the strongest budgets and economies in the G20.
In short, the government spent less and collected more than it had originally predicted. Katie Gallagher is the Finance Minister.
Making sure we're running as a government that's as efficient as possible in terms of our programs, and we've got some more savings to deliver through that, the commitments we took to the election campaign, and of course banking about 70% of our upward revision on revenue. So this is a result of all of that hard work, and that hard work continues. Obviously there's pressures on the budget, they continue, well, from my point of view, it feels like they continue to grow. So there's more work to do, and we'll take the same approach as we work through MyEFO and into budget next year.
The lower-than-expected spending mainly related to the National Partnership Agreements, payments from the federal government to the states, which were nearly $3 billion lower than expected. However, those lower payments weren't due to government decisions. Rather, they were a case of timing. For example, the spend on housing was $600 million lower than expected, but mainly because the state governments didn't meet the requirements to receive that federal money. And the Coalition was quick to point out, even if the deficit is smaller than expected, it's still a deficit. Opposition leader Susan Lee says the government is still spending too much.
I gave a speech at the Committee for Economic Development Australia recently, which talked about the importance of fiscal guardrails and actually having budget rules that restrain spending. Because what we now see from this government is no rules, no guardrails, and $50,000 per minute in Labor debt. The most rapidly growing item in the budget is repayment on debt.
The national debt as a percentage of GDP has been steadily increasing since 2007 under Labor and Coalition governments. Ms Lee didn't expand on what those fiscal guardrails should be, or what money the government is spending that her party would cut back. Economists have greeted the news with cautious optimism. Chief Economist at EY Oceania, Sherelle Murphy, says it's a good result, buoyed by higher-than-expected tax revenue.
It's also due to company tax receipts being really quite strongly above where they were expected to be. So an extra $5.3 billion over the last 9 months coming in just from higher than expected company tax collections. Also individuals, so taxpayers like you and I, as we pay our personal income tax, that was also a lot stronger. Yes, look, certainly some of that reflects stronger wages and better labour market outcomes, but that's not the whole story. There is definitely some more coming in from the corporate sector and including superannuation taxes as well.
However, Cheryl Murphy says the government still has a challenge getting the budget under control.
On the basis of current policy, the government is expecting to spend more than it brings in, which means that the budget position deteriorates structurally. That can change, of course, and numbers such as those that we've seen today are evidence that it does change and can change quite dramatically.
Something that could shake that up is the Reserve Bank, which is set to announce its decision on whether to cut interest rates tomorrow afternoon.
Luke Radford reporting. The Federal Opposition and the Greens are calling for comprehensive investigations after the telecommunications company Optus had another outage on the weekend. 9 calls to the 000 emergency line failed to go through in the Illawarra region south of Sydney yesterday. That outage came after hundreds of calls to 000 failed to get through during an outage in several states a fortnight ago. 3 people died during those incidents. But the federal government doesn't believe an investigation into the entire telecommunications network is warranted. Diana Damjanovic prepared this report.
Optus's troubles have been big news lately, and Australians are taking note. For this man on his lunch break in Sydney, his faith in the telecommunications company is broken.
Pretty negative with it. I don't believe they're a good company. I wouldn't want to be with them. I used to be with them, but I've transferred over.
He says he left Optus 3 years ago after his data was involved in a hacking scandal.
I think when they leaked our data, that was one of the reasons why I transferred to a different provider. With this new 000 issue, it just doesn't seem like a reliable company and they failed us.
Optus has today confirmed a problem with a mobile phone tower in the Illawarra region south of Sydney on Sunday meant 9 callers couldn't get through to 000. It follows an outage across the country earlier this month that led to hundreds of failed 000 calls, including 3 calls where a person died. The opposition says the government has failed to manage the crisis. Shadow Communications Minister Melissa McIntosh is calling for an investigation into the 000 network.
People across Australia need to have confidence in our 000 network. These are lives that are at risk. And the government seems to not be having any sense of urgency, any sense of prioritisation, and yet we are in this position again.
The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says the government is taking the outages seriously.
Optus has clearly failed here on a number of fronts. Our focus as a government is getting to the bottom of what went wrong. We've instructed ACMA to investigate. We'll obviously be closely monitoring that investigation, and we will consider throughout this process whether further actions are necessary.
There are also concerns about the person Optus has appointed to investigate the company, with a conflict of interest now being raised. Graham Hughes is a consumer expert from Griffith University.
Dr. Kerry Schott was obviously the chair of NBN who appointed Mr. Roux, the current CEO of Optus. So the impartiality of the report is really something that's called into question.
And when it comes to how these various crises affect the way people think about Optus, advertising industry expert Karen Ferry says customers will have lost faith in the company.
You know, it's not just the inconvenience of not being able to call your friend or to message your mum to pick you up. We're talking about the fact that you can't call 000 and that there has been a huge impact on human life because of that. That is a monumental product failure in the way that consumers would see it.
Karen Ferry says rebuilding that trust with customers will be extremely difficult.
For a company like Optus, that's a huge problem. Like the brand impact on top of that is that they will be seen as untrustworthy, but it's not so much brand damage as it is product and business damage. So it goes beyond just something that a brand can fix and is actually something that's going to take such a long time for them to be able to repair in consumers' minds.
She says advertising strategies such as feel-good commercials and light and fluffy storytelling won't be able to cut through the reputational damage plaguing Optus, and the process could take as long as a decade.
And I think for them, it's going to be really hard to fix this through the usual ways that brands would fix it. So I think we're going to see over the next few years, Optus having to do a lot of work in announcing to the public how they're improving network services, but also who they're bringing in to establish that this will never happen again.
Police say everyone who was unable to contact 000 during the Optus outage in the Illawarra region of New South Wales yesterday has been checked on and is okay.
Diana Damjanovic reporting. The peak body for Australia's tech companies is warning the nation will struggle to lift its productivity if more women don't study for so-called STEM degrees, that's science, technology, engineering and maths, and once they enter the workforce, be encouraged to stay in those fields. The Tech Council of Australia has found women over the age of 40 are leaving their STEM jobs at almost double the rate of their male colleagues. Kimberly Price has more.
Long before Ruwangi Fernando embarked on a career in artificial intelligence, her fascination with science and technology began at school.
I loved maths from a very young age. I loved the curiosity and the logic behind it.
Born and raised in Sri Lanka, Dr. Fernando went to university in that country before completing her PhD at Victoria University in Melbourne. When it comes to science, technology, engineering and mathematics, or STEM, she found there were more women studying those subjects at university in Sri Lanka than here.
We had a significant portion of women, not maybe 50% in the tech sector. But I've seen a very interesting phenomenon in Australia. There is a little bit of a, you know, negative form of young kids getting involved, especially girls, in STEM studies.
The Tech Council of Australia's report called The Leaky Pipeline found only 20% of engineering and technology students are women. That means Australia needs to increase women's enrolment in technical degrees by 75% to match countries with the highest rates of enrolment. After starting STEM Sisters, an organisation supporting women of colour in the industry, Dr. Fernando hopes more women embark on senior roles in the sector.
If they can't see the role models, if they can't see their mothers and aunties who have done STEM degrees, don't want to pursue that as a career. So we are expecting to have 1.2 billion tech workers by 2030, and that number to fulfill, we need all hands on deck.
But the data shows women aged 40 and over are walking away from jobs in the highly technical workforce at almost double the rate of their male colleagues. Irene Tsang is the founder and CEO of Lift Women, which invests in female startup businesses. She thinks women are leaving because of negative workplace cultures.
It's still a very male-dominant industry. There were studies 2 years ago show that actually 38% of the girls or women, they would not prefer to choose a job in tech because they think it's a boys' club. They think there's a bro culture, that everything they say, they will be judged. Or in the room, actually, they're the minority.
Another impact on women's careers is motherhood. Irene Tsang believes more supportive workplaces for families is crucial to keeping women in their roles.
The problem is technology industry evolved too quickly. Things change. And once they're out of touch, they're not in that. Sometimes they don't feel they belong.
Lisa Harvey-Smith is a professor of practice at the University of New South Wales, Sydney, and a former Australian Government Women in STEM ambassador. She says innovative reform within the sector is needed to ensure women stay and have an enriching career.
We've got to look at, you know, better approaches to things like the four-day week or potentially, you know, more innovative ways to deal with the workplace. The rise of working from home has been a boon, but there are many more ways in which we can improve the way we work in Australia. And I think the productivity will follow.
As the federal government looks at ways to improve economic productivity, Lisa Harvey-Smith believes part of the solution is engaging women in STEM.
51% of Australians are women. And, you know, leaving out women from innovation and technology is obviously a shot in the foot, really, for ourselves. But also women bring unique insights, experiences of the world.
Professor Lisa Harvey-Smith is an astrophysicist at the University of New South Wales. Kimberly Price reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. In Eastern Europe, voters in Moldova have sent a strong message to Vladimir Putin by backing the nation's pro-Europe ruling party over its pro-Russian rival in the weekend's parliamentary election. Many observers say it's the most important poll since Moldova declared its independence from the USSR in 1991 and could move the nation closer to membership of the European Union. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
Landlocked between Ukraine and Romania, many Moldovans voted with one intention. Only good things, peace. For everything to be positive, this voter said. The wish for peace runs deep as war rages on Moldova's border. With almost all votes counted, the pro-European party of Moldovan President Maia Sandu, the Party of Action and Solidarity, has come out on top, securing 50.1% of the vote. The pro-Russian patriotic bloc garnered just 24%, despite claiming a win as polls closed. Ben Wellings is an associate professor of politics and international relations at Monash University.
It seems like the pro-EU party has just secured victory by a very slim margin. And I think this speaks to a kind of a wider contest of loyalties, particularly in that region that Moldova is part of that borders on Russia.
Igor Grosu is the leader of the winning party. As polls closed, he thanked voters.
We thank everyone who went to the polling stations and responded to our call to participate in the elections. This is a very important decision for the Republic of Moldova. We saw attempts to interfere in the electoral process by criminal groups supported by the Russian Federation.
The claims of Russian interference in this election were widespread, but Russia has rejected the allegations. According to the Central Election Commission of Moldova, voter turnout was just over 52%, which is higher than previous years. Denis Chinusa is a fellow with the Democratic Resilience Program at the Centre for European Policy Analysis. He says the turnout isn't surprising.
We have seen a very intense electoral campaign. Both camps used the war narratives in order to mobilize their voters.
This election was, of course, seen as a crucial choice between the country's path to the EU or a step closer to Russia. Moldova applied for European Union membership in March 2022 and was granted candidate status 3 months later. Accession negotiations were formally opened mid-last year. Associate Professor of Politics Ben Wellings again.
Moldova sits outside the European Union. It's part of the so-called Eastern Neighbourhood Partnership. So it's got a close relationship with the European Union. This is part of long-standing attempts that predate the war in Ukraine, it should be said, to lock that eastern region into the EU's orbit more than Russia. And of course, although Russia complains about NATO encroachment, the EU is sort of part of that picture as well, seeking to extend its influence along its borders eastwards to bring more of these countries into its fold. So as we know, the UK came out 5 years ago, the centre of European gravity is shifting a bit further to the east, where people are quite keen to be involved rather than wanting to leave.
What do you think this election result means in terms of the ongoing bid for EU accession?
Well, I mean, it's good for EU accession, of course, as far as Moldova is concerned. It sends the right message. A loss by the pro-EU party would, of course, complicated the very long process that accession takes. Accession, with the exception of Ukraine, which was for geostrategic and political reasons, is on a kind of a fast track. It can take 10, 15, 20 years in some cases, because there are a lot of things, from laws to trade to a commitment to join the single currency at some point, that need to be aligned before a country can accede. And one of the things that the EU is keen on when countries accede is that they don't have outstanding border disputes. So of course, there's an element of risk for the EU in expanding eastwards. I mean, it might antagonize the Russians, but of course, it brings the EU's borders closer to Russia. Nonetheless, it does expose the EU to a measure of risk, But at the same time, this isn't seen to be an acceptable risk by people in Brussels because it's about bringing more countries into the EU orbit.
Associate Professor Ben Willings from Monash Uni, Tanya Dendrinos, the reporter. A new landmine detector invented in Australia is soon to be used in war-ravaged Ukraine. The technology is the result of a partnership between the National Science Agency, the CSIRO, and a private company. Its developers say it's revolutionary because rather than detecting metal, the device searches for the explosive itself. Julia Bergen filed this report.
Until now, finding landmines has involved a metal detector and a lot of guesswork.
The metal detector goes off and says there's something metallic here.
John Shanahan is speaking to us from the outskirts of Kyiv in Ukraine, where he's in a car travelling to a landmine site.
The depth could be anything from laid on the surface to about 15 centimetres below surface. And so just short of where they think the mine is, whether it's pouring rain or boiling hot, they will then start digging down by hand.
John Shanahan heads up a company called MREED, which specialises in landmine removal technology. He says the problem with traditional detectors is they pick up anything that's metal. For every one landmine they find, they also detect 134 pieces of metal rubbish. And for every one of those false positives, a human has to dig by hand to investigate. Each dig takes 30 to 40 minutes, so it becomes extremely time-consuming.
It could be just bits of old blown-up vehicles. It could be knives, it could be different type of metallic soil. It's just rubbish. It's just nothing explosive there at all. But they have to dig down and treat it as an explosive until they have evidence to prove that it's not.
Ukraine has the highest concentration of landmines in the world, and it's the only country where demining is happening while a war is still raging. The minefields John Shanahan is heading to were, not long ago, the front lines of Russia's assault. He's there to meet a team of workers known in the sector as deminers and show them a new Australian-made landmine detector. What makes it special is that instead of simply detecting metal, this one can tell the difference between bomb and no bomb. Back in Australia, I met with three of John Shanahan's colleagues to learn more. In a small room at the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation at Lucas Heights on Sydney's Southern Fringe, a former CSIRO scientist, an electronics engineer, and a physicist are packed between robotic drivers, 3D printers, various other gadgets, and a whiteboard covered in diagrams and notes.
What you do is you load components on these things on the side here, and this robot picks up the components, places them on the board down to sub-millimetre precision, and then they're soldered into place.
That's the other half of MREED, former CSIRO scientist Nick Cutmore. Put simply, they've invented a device that detects the explosive element in landmines.
Mine detected.
What this thing is doing when you press that button is it's sending out a signal every 7 milliseconds down there, and it sends a radio wave into the ground. Then it turns the signal off and listens for what comes back, accumulates the signal, and then starts all over again. And we add all these things together over seconds to create hundreds and hundreds of analyses, and that gives us enough statistics to say there is a mine here or there isn't a mine here.
The new device looks like a metal detector. It's just shy of 2 metres long, it's got a long shaft with a box of electronics at the top end and what looks like a white lampshade at the bottom. That's the sensor.
The way that this works in the field is the operator holds this, puts their arm through the holding point, holds on to the pistol grip here like a crutch, and then holds this over the ground where we're trying to detect in a minefield.
This is an old prototype, the one the team has already tested in Angola and Cambodia. It weighs about 10 kilograms. The new version will be half that for their next big project in Ukraine. That's why John Shanahan's in the country and why Nick Cutmore and his colleagues are working round the clock to make the device smaller and faster.
You can actually see it here. So this is the old system. All of that, lots of rat's nest of cables. And we're trying to shrink it down to about this size.
Yeah, that's the size.
Okay, so it's, what, like a third? Even more?
Well, actually, probably more like 80% shrink. Someone eventually, right, is carrying it into a minefield. The minefield is partly cleared of vegetation. It's often semi-jungle. It's filled with all sorts of hazards as well as the mines. And so you need to create technology which is light enough to carry, to use all day, in 35 degrees heat, carry it around, hold it in place, detect mines, go about their work for the whole day and do that smoothly. If we implement our technology as we plan, we could speed global demining by at least 30%.
Clear.
Nick Cutmore from Australian tech company M Reed, Julia Bergen reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. In the skies above Europe, there's been a worrying trend in recent weeks with Russia violating the airspace of a growing number of countries. Today, Max Bergman from the Centre for Strategic and International Studies on what Vladimir Putin is up to and what Europe should do about it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.